8 o'clock, having arrived, I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order. We do not have a quorum yet, and when we do, we'll probably stop at that point in a few minutes and so forth. But what we're doing today is we have Ms. Temple and Ms. Schill. They are going to go over the tax conformity and first go over basically what would be the numbers. We talked about a number of different provisions that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provided, and this assumes the first thing we're looking at, that we conform just to everything and without any other type of Minnesota policy change. So you're going to see kind of what that would be, and then after that we're going to look at some actual numbers on these provisions that were in bills from last year, and then that probably should take a half hour or so, and after that, then we have about 20 testifiers that will talk about tax conformity, but also basically introduce themselves. And I will say the first one up on the testifiers will be Mr. Brower from the Certified Public Accountants. We want to hear, and we're going to give them a few more minutes than everyone else, just because tomorrow we're going to have Commissioner Bowerly in to talk about the filing this season and how that's going and so forth. So, and we may not have time for the CPA, so we're going to hear from them today on how that goes. So with that, Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I have also asked my colleague Kathy Schill to also come with me to review the revenue estimate and the property tax interactions contained in the revenue estimate. And for our presentation today, we'll be working off two documents that you should have in your packet. First is the revenue estimate, looks like this. And then we have a tracking sheet from 2018 that looks like this. To start, we'll be talking about the revenue estimate. And just, we wanted to kind of walk through the estimate just to give you familiarity with what these estimates look like and how to read them. The estimate that you have before you is prepared by the Minnesota Department of Revenue's Tax Research Division, and it shows the general fund revenue impact of federal conformity to the Internal Revenue Code as of March 2018. With no corresponding Minnesota tax policy changes, none of the changes that Mr. William talked about regarding family size adjustments or any, there's no base Brodners in this estimate. And the generally accepted nomenclature for this type of kind of scenario for federal conformity is called mechanical conformity. We often refer to that in the tax committee with this type of estimate. We call it a mechanical conformity estimate. A couple of things about the estimate. Let's see. You can see at the top there is a summary by tax type, and the positive numbers show a revenue gain, and any negative numbers show a tax reduction. The numbers are prepared for the budget forecast window, which is fiscal 18 to fiscal 2023. This estimate has no impact in fiscal 18, so it is not shown. This estimate is also based on the November 2018 MMB forecast, and it will be updated again in its entirety when the February forecast is released, probably in late February or March.
Ms. Templin, before you go on, we now do have a quorum. So would anyone care to make a motion on the minutes? Representative Becker Finn?
So moved, Mr. Chair. Move the minutes from our last meeting.
Okay, and that would be Tuesday, January 22nd. Motion to approve. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does carry. The minutes are approved. All right. Thank you, Ms. Templin.
And Mr. Chair, on the revenue estimate, just to summarize, you can see with mechanical conformity, For fiscal, I'll just take fiscal 22 and 23, there is a revenue gain of $591,430 million. And for fiscal 2023, it's $635,500 million would be a revenue gain. The total, and it's not summarized in the sheet before you, is $1.2 billion for the fiscal 2022-23 biennium. So pages 1 through 4 of the estimate before you give you a kind of high-level overview of the tax provisions of what would be in what we call mechanical conformity. The page 4 of the estimate just kind of reviews the department's methodology, any assumptions that they make, and it also clarifies what forecast it's based on. And then pages 5 through 9 show the cost of each of the individual provisions within mechanical conformity. And just a couple of notes about how to read the table starting on page 5. So as you can see, the estimate shows, for example, the cost of increasing the standard deduction to $24,000, and it shows the cost for the 4 years. And so the cost would be in fiscal 2023, $1,027,000,000. And also on that provision specifically, you can also, one of the ways to decode if this is a permanent provision or a permanent cost or a temporary cost is to look at in the description of the provision in parentheses. It shows tax year 19 through 25. And that indicates that is a temporary provision. Just one side note kind of about this page specifically. A lot of the provisions on this page can be modeled by the department and by Mr. Williams and House Research in the HITS model. And so these specific estimates, you can get a lot of more detail beyond what's in the revenue estimate if like incidence information is needed. But that's just an aside and a tangent about these provisions. Moving on
so,
to
Templin, before you move on, just for on that first part there where you're talking about increasing the standard deduction and then suspending the personal and dependent exemption. So if Minnesota just went with federal taxable income and just conformed to that, but this shows that in fiscal year 2020, that would equate between those two a $296 million tax increase.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. So you can see there's a cost with increasing the standard deduction, and then the next line shows a revenue gain from repealing the personal and dependent exemption. So with a net change of a positive $296.2 million in fiscal 20.
Thank you.
Moving along, I guess on that same page, we can just cover those provisions. Like for education-related provisions, the net change is a negative $800,000 in fiscal 20. And for federal deductions, the sum of those changes with suspending certain itemized deductions all the way down to the charitable deduction not allowed for amounts paid for college athletic events, the subtotal is a revenue gain of $89.6 million. So the first page shows a lot of the tax changes for individual income tax. The rest of the estimate shows a lot of the revenue impact for what we call individual business or pass-through provisions or S corporations. So, for example, thank you, bonus depreciation. There is Mr. Williams and Mr. Clayman talked about bonus depreciation and the 5-year recovery. With the 80% add back, this is a temporary provision and it affects both individual income tax and corporate tax. In fiscal 2023, that provision raises $11.5 million. And there is another provision for increased 179 expensing. This is a permanent provision. Again, this is with the 80% add back and five-year recovery, and that has a revenue gain to both individual income taxes and corporate taxes of $1.1 million. Another provision I wanted to also mention is Mr. Williams and Mr. Klayman also discussed the 20% deduction for pass-throughs. That is shown on page 6, kind of in the middle of the page under other business and investment provisions. You can see for fiscal 20 and 23, that is a revenue reduction of $308 million in 2023. That cost is, you know, roughly in the $300 million range for the window that provision is authorized. And then there is another temporary provision, the disallowance through losses for married joint filers, $500,000. That has a revenue gain in fiscal 2023 of $41.6 million. So the rest of page 6 and page 7 shows a lot of what we would call base expansion provisions within TCGA. A lot of the provisions raise revenue during the budget forecast window. Other than the two that I mentioned, or the three, all the rest are permanent. And again, you can see that they're permanent if they say for the most part, if they say beginning in tax year 19. And then on page 8 of your estimate, it continues the base broadeners for individual income tax or pass-throughs. And you can see at the bottom there are subtotals with the revenue change. In addition to the impact on individual income tax and corporate tax, there is a provision for unrelated business income tax, what we call UBIT taxes. There is a revenue gain for unrelated business income of charitable organizations, separately computed for each trade or business activity, that has a revenue gain of $2.9 million in fiscal 2023. And there is an additional provision related to bond interest that has a revenue gain of $9.3 million. And then finally, on the last page of the estimate is page 9, and it shows the individual business income tax revenue impacts to both corporate tax and income tax. And Mr. Klayman discussed the deemed repatriation provision. This is both a retroactive provision and a kind of temporary provision. It's temporary in that the revenue gain comes over 6 years, or excuse me, 8 years, or it could, I guess, by federal law, they have written it so that the businesses are to pay over 8 years, and the estimate assumes that the revenue gain will come over 8 years. In fiscal 2023, the revenue gain for deemed repatriation, as you can see, is $113.8 million. And then the other provisions for GILTI has an impact. That is a permanent provision. It affects both individual income tax and corporate tax, and you can see the revenue gain there. And at the bottom, there are subtotals. And then for property taxes, Ms. Schill will talk about there's interaction with other taxes because of federal conformity.
Ms. Schill?
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Analysis. Yes, usually with federal conformity, the changes are not so great to impact property taxes or property tax refunds at all. But in this case with the TCJA, the suspension of the exemptions for dependents and senior disabled filers, there's a significant impact with that, those suspensions of the exemptions, that it impacts the calculation of the property tax refund. And so both for homeowners, which is the homestead credit state refund, and for renters, there's an impact of approximately, when you add them together, about $90 million in fiscal 2023. In addition to that, there are modifications to the federal adjusted gross income. Those are the items above the line that Mr. Williams talked about. There's some additional changes, moving expenses, the interest on student loans, a few other items. Those also change income parameters affecting the calculation. And those costs, both for homeowners, homestead credit state refund, and for renters, have an impact of about for $580,000 in fiscal 2023.
And Mr. Chair, just again to summarize, you can see at the bottom all provisions, the revenue impact. There is a net revenue gain for every year in the budget forecast window with mechanical conformity to all tax types starting in fiscal 20 to 2023. And this is a revenue estimate. As you can see, this is not a fiscal note. It does not have any operational or administrative cost for the department or any other agency contained in the revenue estimate. These revenue estimates just show the revenue change to the tax law provisions in federal conformity, and specifically this estimate addresses what we call mechanical conformity. So I hope that that gives a high-level overview of the revenue estimate and kind of how to read them, because you'll probably be seeing several of them in the next few weeks. Then I will turn your attention to a spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet is in legal size. And I forgot my ruler, so this is hard for me to read, too. We recommend rulers in reading this, and magnifying glasses, if you can come across one. So this is a spreadsheet from the 2018 session, and it shows the House File 947. This was a vetoed tax bill, and it compares the legislature's proposal, or the conference committee's proposal, to what passed the House floor, the Senate floor, and what was proposed by the governor. Each of the columns in the spreadsheet, you know, there was a revenue estimate behind each of them. For, you know, the governor had a revenue estimate, the House and the conference committee, and so on. And those revenue estimates populate the spreadsheet.
So, Ms. Templin, so members, as we go through this, we're not debating the various plans from last year. What I'd like to do, though, if you have a question about a particular number, that's certainly fair, but we won't go back and resurrect 2018. So, Ms. Templin.
Okay. So the spreadsheet, Mr. Chair, shows that these are all changes in thousands. These are changes to tax revenues. And they are grouped by, the changes are grouped by TCJA provisions for individuals, the impact on individuals, and then there's a subtotal for individual pass-throughs and a subtotal for corporate taxes. Now, starting on lines 1 through 19, you're looking at the impact to individuals specifically, and you can see around line 5, the revenue loss associated with changing to FAGI and going to chained CPIU, the cost in fiscal 18 and 19 was $23.2 million, and there was a revenue gain of $10.3 million. As you can see, what passed out of conference committee was similar to what was in the Senate bill. Yeah, they had a similar kind of structure for federal conformity and FAGI related to itemized deductions.
So, Ms. Templin, you were on that vetoed bill, that area, the veto
yes, chapter? Yes, yes, around five. Line five.
Okay.
Or four. Can't okay. see. Oh, column, yeah, thank you. That would be columns.
Ms. Yeah, Templin, H, columns.
H through M.
Yeah, okay, very good.
And then the cost of the, on line eight, of the medical expense deduction, the conference committee authorized the 7.5% kind of floor. The cost was $26.4 million in fiscal 18 and 19 and $3.4 million in fiscal 20 and 21. And again, those that is shown on in column J and column M.
Oh, Ms. Temple, I think that's zero.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's just $26.4 million in fiscal 18 and 19. Thank you. And so the sum of the individual income tax provisions on line 19 in fiscal 18 and 19 is a revenue reduction of $72.9 million and $37.7 million in fiscal 2021. So this just kind of walks you through the major cost provisions of federal conformity and kind of what was passed out of the legislature last session. So on the same page, lines 22 through 38 start showing the revenue change for individual pass-through provisions. And a couple of the big ones that were contained in the 2018 bill include full conformity to Section 179 expensing. And that is shown on line 22, and that has an effective date of tax year 18, and that had a revenue loss, an estimated revenue loss, or projected of $81.6 million in fiscal 18 and 19, and $85.2 million in fiscal 20 and 21. There is also conformity to bonus depreciation, except this is with the 80% add-back five-year recovery that was discussed last year. That bonus depreciation had a revenue gain of $400,000 on line 24 of your spreadsheet and $19.4 million in the tails. And one of the things I wanted to mention is that we heard about in the presentation yesterday was the qualified business income deduction, and that had a cost of about $300 million. The 2018 bill did not conform to that, so that is not in the spreadsheet, and you won't see it here. You just see provisions that were conformed to and, you know, approved and authorized. So I just wanted to bring that up. So that the cost is not in the tracking sheet because it was not included. And then another provision is the conformity to the limitation on the net interest deduction to 30% of income. That is on line 31, and that has a revenue gain of, I'm sorry, having trouble with my lines. That has a revenue gain of $102.1 million. And $183 million in fiscal 2021. So on the next page, on page two of your estimate, that shows the rest of the provisions that affect individual income tax pass-through provisions. And as you can see on the spreadsheet, a lot of the provisions are base expansion, so expansion provisions, so they have a kind of net effect of a revenue gain. Line 47 shows the revenue gain of $69.2 million for what was in the vetoed bill and $291.1 million in the tails. And then lines 50 through 75 show the revenue impact just to corporate tax. And again, there is impact to corporate tax with Section 179 expensing and bonus depreciation. And we talked about those already, but there's also a cost or a revenue gain with those provisions, and they're reflected in the spreadsheet. But one item that I also wanted to just bring your attention to is repatriation, the international business provisions that were discussed by Mr. Klayman yesterday on line 71. The impact of deemed repatriation is shown on the spreadsheet as raising $56 million in fiscal 18 and 19 and $68.2 million in the 2021 biennium. What was authorized in the conference committee was slightly different compared to what the governor and the Senate proposed for deemed repatriation. And then finally, the sum of the changes to the base broadeners for corporate income tax, you can see on line 75, there's a revenue gain of $81.1 million. In fiscal 18 and 19, and $198.2 million in the tails. And then we come to the interaction with property tax refunds, and Ms. Schill will discuss those.
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair, members, Kathy Schill once again. Line 78 through 82 on the spreadsheet show the interactions with the property tax refund. You can just note the difference between the revenue estimate that we just went over previous to the tracking sheet. The changes that were agreed to in conference committee are significantly different and create less of an impact on the property tax refunds for individual taxpayers. So line 78, 79 show modifications once again to FAGI. And those impacts are in 20 and 21, $70,000 for homeowners, $30,000 for renters. Lines 81 and 82, instead of the changes to the exemptions, you have the impact of using the chain CPIU. And those impacts are about $1 million in the first year of the tails and about $2 million in the second year of the tails for a total impact 2021 found on line 82 of $3.2 million. So significantly different than totally conforming to what was shown in the most recent revenue estimate.
So Ms. Templin, I think I'm going to have you go pass the Bipartisan Budget Act. Those are minor items, and maybe go to the last line, line 130 on the last page.
Mr. Chair, as line 130 of the spreadsheet on page 4 shows the estimated revenue gain for that was proposed by each body. The conference committee, you can see for federal conformity, the revenue estimated revenue gain was $53.1 million and $456.1 million in fiscal 2021, and you can compare that to what was proposed by the governor and what was passed out of the floors for the House and the Senate during the 2018 session. And that concludes the overview of the spreadsheet, unless you have specific questions.
Oh. Well, thank you very much. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you mentioned, or I guess yesterday we talked about how, like, so there are these base broadening measures that are part of the TCJA with respect to the corporate tax. But then at the beginning, you also said that the rates were cut by 40% overall. Mm-hmm. And so I guess a couple things on that. I'm just kind of, because, you know, you're looking at this, you're like, oh, wow, look, you know, it's all positive, it's all this money, but then we know that the estimate is that, like, the federal tax, the TCJA on a federal level is going to cost $2.2 trillion, I think they said. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm just trying to, like, understand the relationship between, like that reality and what I'm seeing in front of me, and then also, like, if we like, do we have the option to do the base expansion provisions of the TCJA without doing the overall rate cut for corporations? And, yeah, I guess that's it.
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, the spreadsheet that you see just from 2018 just shows the impact to federal conformity. The provisions related to rate reductions and income taxes and corporate taxes, that was an additional part of the spreadsheet that is not shown, so that would be a cost. So that is not reflected in what you see. Right now, that is right now. You just see the revenue impact of the federal conformity package that was authorized by the conference committee. Now, I think you may have also mentioned that there's corporate tax reductions at the federal level. That has no impact on federal taxable income, so that is not reflected in the revenue estimate. But the base runners do affect federal taxable income, so that is why it is included in the revenue estimate.
Thank you. So thank you, Ms. Templin, and thank you, Representative Gomez, for that question. So the conformity is going to raise revenue. And then it's at that point that kind of where you know, depending on what you do with this will raise revenues. And then in the plans last year, there was a number of ways in which you can handle that revenue. It could be corporate tax cut rates, could be individual marginal rate cuts. The governor had working family credit. He had another type of credit in there. So there's a number of ways then you can use those dollars. And that's really one of the major things that, of course, this committee will do as we put together a bill on tax conformity. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other thing. I need a second to find it. Hold on. I'm sorry.
You guys should go on. I'll come back.
Okay.
Oh, no, I got it. I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. So I'm looking at the TCJA conformity corporate franchise tax lines 50 to 75. And, the revenue estimates are really starkly different between the governor's plan and all the other ones. And so, to me, the thing that jumped out was line 70, deemed repatriation of foreign income. So, the governor's plan has, $500 million or whatever this is. And then the others don't. So I wonder if you could just, explain that provision to me and why is it that in the governor's proposal, had this huge line item for that and none of the other ones did? Or, what is that? Can you explain that a little more? Sorry if we went over it yesterday. I'm kind of trying to...
No.
Ms. Templin, there were two approaches to dealing with deemed repatriation, one by the governor and one by the House. So can you talk about the differences mechanically between those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, I believe you're looking at lines 70 and 71, and the governor, his proposal approved or authorized a deemed repatriation, and his proposal reflected more what was reflected in the mechanical conformity. It didn't make any modifications to kind of TCJA. The House proposal, the governor's proposal raised a lot more revenue. The House proposal conformed to deemed repatriation, but made additional modifications, and it was deemed repatriation of the net amount, and it was modified compared to what the governor proposed, and so what the conference committee did eventually approve. That provision for deemed repatriation, because it was modified, raised less revenue. It raised $56 million and $68.2 million in the tails, and that's why those two items are shown on different lines, because they are different and they raise different amounts of revenue. And then the governor also conformed to what we call the GILTI and the FITI provisions on line 72 and 73, And he and the sum of those provisions adds a lot more revenue on the governor's side for corporate taxes and base broadeners.
So, thank you. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you, Ms. Schill and Ms. Templin. Let us not forget that the bill that was passed last year and went to the governor's desk, corporations did pay more. There's that myth out there that old big corporations did so well. That's not true at all. They did pay more, and the reason that there is less money booked for foreign money is because there were clearly constitutional issues, if you remember the testimony from last year, clearly constitutional issues. Had we gone forward with the governor's plan, would have been totally and completely irresponsible because they would have taken us to court and we would have lost. And so when we look at this from last year, let's keep in mind that, number one, corporations paid more, and number two, if we had not taken the House position, it would have been totally irresponsible in the state. We had to even go so far, Mr. Chairman, to figure out how do we pay that back when we lose. So that's just a little history lesson.
Thank you. Ms. Templin, Ms. Schill, anything further on this? Thank you very much, and thanks for the kind of how to go through the spreadsheets and revenue estimates. We'll be seeing them as we come forward here.
Don't forget to bring your rulers. It's pretty important.
Thank you very much. So much of this committee's work is going to be looking at all of those various options on dealing with the revenue gains and the base broadeners on businesses and so forth. That's going to be a major task of this committee. So with that, we're going to open up the testifiers. And what I would like is David Brower from CPAs to begin, and then Jill Larson, Minnesota Business Partnership, is on deck. So if you could also join him at the desk there. And so if you would please state your name and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Brower. I'm a tax partner at Lurie LLP, a Minnesota-based CPA firm with offices in Minneapolis and Fort Myers. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. I'm here to talk about the impact of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act on our profession and how we've been getting ready for this filing season, and also specifically how the lack of conformity has affected what we are doing also.
And Mr. Brower, I am going, as I said earlier, I'm going to give you about 4 or 5 minutes. Everyone else is going to have about 2 to 3 minutes if we're going to make it through here the hour. So please proceed.
Thank you. This tax bill came about in December of 2017, and although not as broad as some of the bills in the past, it has some very large provisions that...
Mr. Brower, would you speak more into that? I think we have some members have problems. Thank you very much.
Yes. This bill, although not as broad as some bills in the past, has many of the most difficult provisions and complicated provisions that we've seen. I've been practicing for 24 years on the tax side, and this one is something that is causing lots of education, lots of reading that we've been doing over the past year, and still getting guidance from the federal government on how to implement many of those provisions. Last Friday, there was another 270 pages just on the pass-through deduction that spent the weekend reading and trying to educate the rest of my firm and taxpayers. I spent the last year probably have done about 30 presentations to members of the state of Minnesota, individuals and businesses on the impact. It's about an hour-long presentation, and the last 5 minutes I spend talking about how you can ignore everything I've talked about for filing your Minnesota state tax returns because none of these provisions at this point are applicable. And we would have to redo the tax returns using old law to figure out the tax implications in for the state tax filing. There's been lots of talk about the depreciation and those calculations and some of the other items, and the depreciation and how this would impact our clients and what they would have to do. And in the profession, we're estimating even a simple by most means, tax return will require an extra hour to 2 hours in order to get the Minnesota tax return filed accurately and correctly. For the more complicated taxpayers who have businesses that flow through or Schedule C provisions, it's countless hours that we may have in making the adjustments to figure out the Minnesota-based income in order to pay the correct Minnesota taxes. These provisions range all the way from still being able to deduct the entertainment expenses, not getting the pass-through deduction. There are interest limitations that are now being imposed on businesses. And on the simple individual returns, we still have that whole discussion about personal exemptions and the itemized deductions. Clients will have to be gathering documents that they would not have to provide for normal if conformity were in place. And the other piece that I'm seeing a lot of my colleagues, neighbors, show consternation about is the people who are filing their own returns and getting the education and making sure that the readily available software on the open market is calculating all these items correctly. Myself, I typically buy one of those products and prepare a tax return just to see what is being allowed or how they are being guided. And I will tell you that a lot of those software provide leading questions that may lead people into deductions that they are not truly entitled to. The other impact that I worry about going forward is with the state of Minnesota and the Department of Revenue and how they would be doing audits in the future. Typically, right now, the Minnesota Department of Revenue relies upon the federal IRS to initiate many of the audits, and then the adjustments are passed through in a simple calculation to figure out what the impact on the amended Minnesota return would be. If many of these provisions are not provided, we may have a federal IRS exam that makes large changes that wouldn't be applicable to any change associated with the Minnesota. And therefore, Minnesota would probably have to initiate many more audits directly upon themselves and incur that cost of additional compliance. As a profession, as a business owner, we look at these extra hours that all our people are going to have to take to file additional returns. We file about 7,000 returns in our office, and an extra hour to 5 hours per return is a significant amount of time that we would have to incur and most likely pass along to our clients who are very concerned about the additional fees that they will incur in order to correctly file their tax returns this year.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brower, when you were talking about itemizations and that the Minnesota filer now would have to keep track of this more than that,
yes,
are you referring to that where they might or not get a deduction now on the federal level, they will on the state level? Because on the state level, that hasn't changed as far as...
Correct.
So if you, on the Minnesota side, that won't change for this year's filing season. So when you said that, did you mean that you were kind of like they'd have to keep track of it more this year? Is it because of the differences with the federal?
Yes. For instance, the 2% miscellaneous itemized deductions, the unreimbursed employee expenses, not a valid deduction any longer for federal purposes. They will have to continue to gather those documents just for determining whether or not they would take an itemized deduction for Minnesota purposes. And it may or may not be get them to a point where it becomes a deduction in Minnesota.
Thank you. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, last year on the first passage of the House bill, we largely conformed to the federal provisions, but the governor and the Senate, very bipartisan, wanted to keep a lot of the current Minnesota deductions so that fewer people would see any type of increase. What would your recommendations be?
Mr. Brower?
What we did was we went Sorry, Mr. Chair, but what we did was we came in and we conformed in the House, the first passage of the House bill. Governor, Senate said, no, we want to keep all these deductions so fewer people have increases. Which would the CPAs prefer?
Mr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative Davids, as far as we go, if we wanted to be as simple as possible, it would be full conformity. It makes it the easiest for everyone to make sure that returns are being filed accurately. We follow what the rules are that are in place, and we would be able to adjust either way. It's most efficient if there was full conformity between the IRS, the federal tax laws, and the Minnesota tax laws.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It just sounds to me like the CPA should be thanking us for having done nothing, because you're going to make a whole lot more money.
Mr. Brower, any closing comments? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brower, I have one question on the conformity, and that has to do with military families. There's a number of our Red Bulls currently who are stationed overseas. What is the impact of conformity versus nonconformity on military families? Do you have any insight for me?
Mr. Brower?
Thank you. Actually, I do not have any military families that I provide guidance for. Not a provision that I've looked at closely. Sorry.
Maybe, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Burke, because I think this is a pertinent question, because I have CPAs at home that have asked this question and are really concerned about it, too. Now that we're into really the beginning of the filing season, what is your take on impact if we were trying to do something yet for the 2018 filing season compared to doing nothing now? I mean, certainly there would be a lot of additional reworking and refiling of claims and so forth as well. So from a CPA standpoint, would you be recommending changes yet for 2018 or going into 2019?
Mr. Brower.
I've seen it happen both ways in the state of Minnesota in the past. There's been provisions that retroactively changed in March, I believe, five years ago. Those were for relatively simple provisions that were easily calculable by computer software and did not require any amended tax returns, and the state of Minnesota refunded any overpayments promptly and efficiently. With the changes that we're looking at in this aspect, the software would not be able to adjust how those would be calculated or impacted or refunded. And if this was done later than early February, it would be, yes, many people would have amended tax returns that they would have to file, which would be an additional cost, which would be additional time. There's also history. I believe it was in the 1990s. I was a younger professional at the time. But there was a provision back in the 90s where there was a depreciation adjustment that was made. And at some point, the state decided to kill that program and just allow for a pickup or a deduction of all the remaining add-backs that had not been recovered at that point. So maybe something that would allow for a catch-up provision in 2019 might be the more efficient way to make that change.
Thank you. Representative Swiecinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. Just visiting with my own tax preparer, he's talked about losing some clientele to, I don't know, Florida. And just wanted to see, like, have you seen that in your own practice? And how has maybe your business adjusted to that? Or what has been your personal experience?
Mr. Brower.
Mr. Chair. Well, as I mentioned, we now have an office in Fort Myers, Florida. I have seen people move out of state for lots of different reasons. Some of them, part of it is a tax reason, maybe not the overlying, but there is an element of that. We would appreciate if one of the basis for determining residency was not the use of professionals in whatever state they might be, those sorts of things. But it is, yes, we have seen many people, and many people come talk to me about residency issues and how it might impact their tax liabilities going forward.
Okay. Final question. Come in. Representative Shorts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brower, are your clients mainly businesses, or do you have a lot of clients that are Minnesota families?
Mr. Brower.
Our clients, as I said, we have about 7,000 returns that we file. I would say it's close to 50-50 on the numbers that are individuals versus businesses. The businesses, not by revenue, but by client, is about 50-50. Obviously, the business returns are a little more complicated, and our revenue is a little skewed toward the business side.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, one
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I guess my concern is if we fully conform with the federal tax law, that it would increase taxes on many people in Minnesota and Minnesota families. So I think we want to take our time this session and reduce that tax liability on working families by not fully conforming and making some significant adjustments.
Mr. Brower, thank you so much for your perspective on this. It's very valuable. Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me, and I'm sure that if anyone has any further questions, any member of the Minnesota Society or myself would be happy to answer questions assist you in any way. Thank you much.
All right, Ms. Larson, and I'm asking members, just if you've got questions, just limit it to just the conformity part of it, if you would. So, Ms. Larson, please introduce yourself, and Nan Madden is on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Jill Larson from the Minnesota Business Partnership. Thanks for the opportunity to provide some brief comments. For those of you that aren't familiar with the Business Partnership, our membership is comprised of the leaders of about 120 of Minnesota's largest employers, most of which are headquartered here in Minnesota. Our member companies, like many businesses, are competing both regionally and internationally. And what they often tell us is that the global growth and investment environment is very competitive, and so that they ask legislators to be mindful of how Minnesota compares with other states and countries when it comes to the tax system. As you all know, we have some of the highest tax rates in terms of personal income, corporate income, business property, and so for that reason, we would hope that you would use federal tax reform conformity as an opportunity to help improve the tax climate. We do support policy changes that both benefit employers and employees. We understand that if you conform just across the board, as has been mentioned earlier, there's going to be tax increases on both individuals and businesses. And we hope that to the extent that you can, that you offset those tax increases with commensurate tax reductions on both individuals and businesses, whether that be through reducing the corporate or individual tax rates, reducing the business property tax, possibly increasing the R&D credit. Those are the types of things that will help Minnesota compete. A note on the international income provisions that's had some discussion here, and I assume it will have more discussion. We believe that adopting those provisions would make Minnesota's tax system more regressive, and it would make Minnesota companies less competitive. As was mentioned by House research staff and Representative Davids, there are some very serious constitutional legal questions about those provisions, and we think that it would also place our companies at a disadvantage against the foreign companies that they're competing with. So with the budget surplus and the opportunities presented to you through conformity, we hope that these recommendations are looked upon favorably. And finally, again, we just ask that as you move forward with tax policy that you keep in mind how our tax climate compares to our competitors. Appreciate the time and opportunity to talk with you, and I'll be getting around to meet a lot of you individually as well. Thank you.
Ms. Larson, thank you much. Nan Madden and Taylor Putz is on deck. So, Ms. Madden, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is a research and advocacy initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We identify and promote public policies to expand opportunity and economic security to all Minnesotans, regardless of who they are or where they live. And we focus primarily on tax, budget, and economic policies and their impact on low and moderate income Minnesotans. We urge that your approach to the federal tax bill be grounded in values that include building a fair tax system in Minnesota and maintaining the revenues needed to sustainably fund our priorities as a state. Some of our specific priorities for conformity include continuing to take family size into account in our tax code and protecting Minnesota's property tax refunds and tax credits for working Minnesotans and their families. Minnesota's current income tax system recognizes that basic family expenses rise with family size. We urge that you continue to do so, whether through a state personal independent exemption or another targeted response. We should not simply conform to the federal tax laws, income tax changes. Doing so would be a state tax increase for the majority of Minnesota families with children. Another priority is protecting property tax refunds. Currently, the property tax refund for both homeowners and renters includes an exemption that provides a larger refund for seniors, people with disabilities, and families with dependents. We think we should keep that exemption in place. Conforming to the federal law would eliminate that exemption, and affected Minnesotans would get smaller property tax refunds than they do today. Third, we would ask you to keep Minnesota's existing method for adjusting the tax code for inflation. We don't think we should follow the federal tax bill's lead and adopt change CPI, which is a slower growing measure of inflation. If we did adopt change CPI, that erodes the value of the working family credit, the child and dependent care credit, and it weakens those tax credits that support Minnesotans' work efforts and help get children off to a strong start. Adopting change CPI would also cause similar erosion in property tax refunds. Finally, we think with a modest state budget surplus and some concerns about the future economic performance, we think it's important to maintain state revenues so that Minnesota can sustainably fund our schools, nursing homes, public safety, the other critical services provided at the state and local level. We don't think Minnesota can afford to enact large additional state tax cuts for those who will receive the largest federal tax cuts, which include high-income households and profitable corporations. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ms. Madden.
Yeah.
Mr. Putz, and then Christine Ulm. And so if the next person would come down to sit at the desk, that would be good, so we'd be ready to go. So Christine Ulm is on deck. So if you would please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Chair Marquardt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Taylor Putz from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, representing 2,300 of the state's nonprofit organizations from very small to large. Minnesotans interact with nonprofits in numerous ways in the course of their daily lives, and sometimes without even realizing it, whether it's attending a weekly church service, participating in a blood drive, or attending class at a university. Nonprofits across the state provide vital services and assistance. Nonprofits are also a steady source of job growth, as one in nine workers in the state are employed by a nonprofit organization. Minnesota has a vibrant charitable sector because of tax policies that promote stronger nonprofits and stronger communities. However, two federal tax changes have nonprofits concerned. The first is related to charitable giving that nonprofits of all sizes rely on to support their work. As you heard yesterday, the number of Minnesotans who have a federal tax incentive to contribute to charities decreased significantly because of the nearly doubling of the standard deduction. Minnesota can handle this differently. Minnesota currently prioritizes charitable giving through the state's charitable deduction for non-itemizers. I look forward to working with you to explore ways to continue Minnesota's strong tradition of charitable giving this session. The second are two provisions related to unrelated business income. The first is a new provision that taxes parking and transportation benefits provided by nonprofits and churches to their employees, such as transit passes and parking spots. And the second provision changes the way nonprofits calculate their unrelated business income, which the legislature and governor did not conform to last year. Together, these provisions add undue complexity and divert resources from nonprofits, which ultimately harm communities. As you put together your tax plan this session, I urge you not to conform to these provisions. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Putz, thank you much. Nick, now up, Christine Ulm and Max Hall is on deck. So, Ms. Ulm?
My name is Christine Ulm. I'm an electrician and a member of the IBW Local 292 in Minneapolis. Thank you, Chair Marquardt and members of the House Tax Committee, for allowing me the opportunity to provide some input today regarding the Minneapolis compliance with the new federal tax laws. I want to let you know that we are asking you to consider not complying with at least one part of the new federal tax code that deals with the non-reimbursable work-related expenses. In the past, expenses that I have had while working and while seeking work have been deductible. The new federal tax law does not allow these deductions, and this will be a hardship on me and my family. This past tax deduction has been by no means a windfall for working families like mine. This tax deduction has helped to make the impact of being unemployed and seeking work or traveling away from our families for employment just a little bit more financially bearable. This new tax law feels like a penalty placed upon us to actively seek to work to put food on our tables. My husband and I are both electricians, and we have both had to seek traveling, or we both have had to seek work outside of the cities here. Mm-hmm. We've both gone in two different directions. I've gone to North Dakota. He's gone to the state of Washington. All the while, it's like supporting three places, you know, Washington, North Dakota, and the family here. You know, it's gas, food, lodging. Traveling isn't always close. He's working here in the state of Minnesota right now. I'm looking to head out to Washington or Oregon here soon. But, you know, and those places that you go are not always cheap to support either. You know, in the oil boom, everybody knows that the lodging out there was not always cheap. You know, small businesses, they get, you know, deductions, you know, the same that we do, you know, such as car and trucks, supplies, licenses, repairs, traveling, meals, and entertainment. It'd be nice that we could have those too. You know, thank you, Chair Marquardt, and the committee for taking my testimony into consideration. Please consider noncompliance with the removal of the federal tax provision that allows us non-reimbursable work-related expenses.
So, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Now up, Max Hall, and on deck, Lars Negsted. So, Mr. Hall.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, my name is Max Hall, and I represent the union members of AFSCME Council 5. We're a labor union, like I mentioned, of 43,000 workers, and we represent everyone from corrections officers to guardians ad litem, child protection officers, assistant county attorneys, support staff at our state agencies, DOT snowplow drivers, maintenance workers, and so many others. So I do appreciate the time given to us this morning to express our thoughts on tax conformity as you start to put together your tax bill for 2019. Excuse me. So AFSCME supports a tax bill that has a net positive impact on working families and makes sure that our tax code is fair, progressive, and ensures that the revenue is there for all of you, the policymakers, to make important and wise decisions in terms of investing in public services and public programs. So for us, there is no question that the 2017 federal tax law significantly, in our opinion, disproportionately benefited the corporations in the United States, and it harmed average working people at the same time. So the federal tax law repealed the child and dependent exemptions, repealed the corporate alternative minimum tax, benefited the wealthiest Americans through increasing the estate tax exemption, repealed or reduced many deductions, and one that you've heard this morning on the unreimbursed employee expenses, and dramatically cut the corporate tax rate, and that's permanent. They made some changes, as you might have heard from House Research, to the individual income tax rates. However, those are due to expire, but the corporate tax rates are permanent. So corporations not just benefited, in our opinion, from the 2017 federal tax law, but they also benefited from the 2017 Minnesota state tax law. So one of a couple of the issues that we had with the 2017 tax law is the freeze on the statewide business property tax, the estate tax exemption increase, and so many other things. It's important that as you draft a tax conformity package, and Representative Schultz reminded us of this, that all committee members should keep working families at the forefront of their minds. These families struggle to pay their rent or their mortgage, pay for their prescriptions or their health care, and save for retirement. And so the last thing that they need is an increase in taxes or bearing the burden of the overall tax structure falling onto them from the federal government. So you're all faced with the difficult task of deciding what Minnesota ought to conform to. And so for Ask Me Council 5, we do support an increase in the working family tax credit so that working families can get some help lowering their tax burden. We would also hope that this committee would make sure that union dues and, like I mentioned, as you heard, unreimbursed employee expenses can be part of your 2019 omnibus tax bill. As far as other conformity issues, we would hope that deemed repatriation would be included and something more along the lines of Governor Dayton. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, I will conclude, but I'll stand for any questions or anything like that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hall.
Yep.
And now up, Lars Nagstedt and Beth Cadoon is on deck. So, Mr. Nagstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lars Nagstedt. I'm the policy director for ISAIAH. ISAIAH is a statewide organization of people of faith working for racial and economic justice. We appreciate the opportunity to testify, and we appreciate your work on this important committee. As people of faith, we're concerned about how we come together to take care of one another. And we see tax policy as an expression of our values. It's an indicator of our morality. Last session, there was a lot of discussion about holding harmless various taxpayers when considering how to craft tax policy. However, that frame kind of ignores the fact that many people are already being harmed by historic levels of inequality and the way tax policy has disproportionately favored the interests of the wealthy and well-connected. So we'd like to submit that conformity should be located in this broader context, and in particular just point out two broad categories, the great needs that our state is experiencing and some fiscal threats on the horizon. In terms of needs, everyone here knows that there are great needs in Minnesota, from our caregiving crisis to the worker shortage to needs in schools and healthcare, among others. I'd like to point out that the actual price of government as a percentage of personal income in our state has dropped over the last 25 years from nearly 18% in 1994 to around 14.8% today. Over that same period, our state has grown increasingly racially diverse. We're concerned that tax policy has become racialized by certain interests who would seek to divide and distract us from solutions that build the common good. In terms of the threats that are looming on the horizon to our budget, I think these are well known but have not been noted yet this morning. For example, the provider tax, if it is allowed to sunset, would blow a giant hole in the state budget. There's also federal impacts in terms of unintended consequence of the reinsurance program that ended up costing hundreds of millions of dollars in lost reimbursement for Minnesota Care from the federal government. And the very impact of the TCJA has led to record corporate profits, stock buybacks, and rising federal deficits, causing further uncertainty about federal spending in the future. Finally, I'd like to note we're in the midst of a record-long federal shutdown impacting many families and many needs in the state of Minnesota. So given this context of the great needs of the people and the fiscal threats on our horizon, we think it's very reasonable for Minnesota to raise revenues we need, especially from corporate taxpayers and the international business income items that have been mentioned before, to ensure fairness on the income tax side and to fund essential services. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nagstedt. And Beth Cadoon is up and Carly Moline is on deck. So, Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're an organization of about 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota of all sizes and all industries.
from those small ma and pa all the way up to the Fortune 500 companies. About 80% of our membership are those with 100 employees or less. We've had a long policy of supporting conformity. It's obviously important that taxpayers can actually comply with our tax laws with as minimal cost and confusion as possible. As you heard from the CPA that was here earlier, there's going to be obviously additional cost and complexity to many of our taxpayers, especially those business taxpayers. So important to comply, but it's also important on what you comply with and how you do so. We'd recommend, as you're looking at tax compliance this year, that you look at it on how we can adopt pro-growth tax policies. We want to make sure that we're encouraging investment, innovation, entrepreneurship, talent recruitment and retention in the state of Minnesota. So we think those are important filters to be looking at as well, and to see how Minnesota is doing as compared to other states, as was mentioned by Ms. Larson earlier as well. One thing we do believe, as you saw from the House nonpartisan staff, is that a lot of these provisions will be increasing taxes if you just adopt the base broadeners. So I said we do believe one of the key principles should be how we can offset those tax increases on those base broadeners with important pro-growth tax reforms. We believe you should focus on looking at those expensing provisions and do full conformity. That does encourage in the investment in the state of Minnesota. Also look at where we're the most uncompetitive, and those are on our rates as well, both at the corporate and individual side. Those can really help offset those tax increases at the same time enacting those, those pro-growth, tax reforms. So we'll look forward to further discussions. Obviously, a lot of policy kind of debates in this issue area, but we hope we can come to some good bipartisan solutions. Thank you.
Ms. Cadoon, thank you very much. Representative Moline is up next, and Aaron Berg is on deck. Representative Moline.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carly Moline, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm here to respectfully request that the state not conform with the federal suspension of the deduction of non-reimbursed employee expenses. We represent approximately 70,000 union construction workers in the state of Minnesota from the following trades: carpenters, electricians, cement masons, bricklayers, heat and frost insulators, iron workers, operating engineers, the pipe trades, laborers, boiler makers, elevator constructors, roofers, sheet metal workers, and painters and allied trades. I hope I didn't forget anyone. If I did, I'll hear about it. Our members are skilled workers in the building and construction trades. Construction careers are built on a lifetime of temporary jobs. Construction of a stadium or a bridge, roofing a business, plumbing a new school, laying a road, those are not jobs that last forever. So many of our members, especially those in greater Minnesota, travel frequently away from home in order to get to a job site. They travel many miles every day, or oftentimes get temporary housing near their job site for weeks or even months, as you heard the previous electrician testify to. These are not expenses covered by their employer. Previously, they were able to itemize these deductions, and under the new federal tax law, that's not the case. I wish I could give you hard facts and figures on how this change impacts construction workers, but most of our information at this point is anecdotal. Many members have gone to their business manager in their trade to express that their inability to deduct these non-employer reimbursed expenses will have a substantial financial impact on their families. For that reason, we'd ask that the state not conform to the federal suspension of unreimbursed employee expenses. Chair Davids had included that fix in his bill last year. Thank you. And on behalf of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, thank you, Chair Marquardt, and members for your time and consideration of this issue.
Thank you very much, Representative Moline. And now up, Aaron Berg and Paul Hager is on deck. And I want to ask at this time, because I don't know if we're going to get through the whole list, is there anyone that absolutely cannot be here tomorrow or have traveled a distance? I want to get you up quick. So raise your hand if you've come from a distance or absolutely could not testify tomorrow at this time. I don't see any hands. Okay, very good.
Chair Marquardt and members of the committee, my name is Erin Hannafin-Berg, and I'm with the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. The Preservation Alliance is a nonprofit organization with a mission to connect people to historic places, promoting community vitality. And I'm here today to emphasize our concern about the effects of conforming to the federal changes to the Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit. When Minnesota enacted a historic tax credit in 2010, we joined 33 other states that have this incentive, which allows an income tax credit equal to 20% of rehabilitation expenses for an income-producing property that is listed in the National Register of Historic Places. Over 100 tax credit projects have been undertaken in Minnesota since 2011, resulting in $3 billion of economic activity. Typically, more than $9 is generated for every dollar allowed in state tax credits. Since the Minnesota Historic Tax Credit was not made to conform with the federal changes last year, and the terms of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act allowed for projects already underway to qualify under the old federal rules, we actually saw an increase in the number of rehabilitation projects approved during fiscal year 2018, 16 projects last year, with 7 in fiscal year 2017. The total estimated economic impact of the Minnesota Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit in 2018 was $715 million. Directly through rehabilitation, the state historic tax credit created over $393 million of construction activity and supported almost 1,700 jobs in the construction sector. My main purpose in being here today is not to share the successes of the historic tax credits, but to point out that changes in the federal laws passed in 2017 have altered the terms for the historic tax credits in such a way that they might not be able to continue their record of success if the state conforms to those federal changes. The problem is that the federal credit, which must be claimed against tax liability, now is required to be taken ratably over a five-year period beginning with the year that the completed project is placed in service. Most historic tax credit projects are incredibly complex, both in terms of the physical work that must be done to make it a deteriorated building usable again, and also in terms of the project financing. Developers partner with investors who buy the tax credits and contribute the capital that is needed to undertake this construction work. The changes at the federal level are expected to reduce the price that investors are willing to pay for the credits by as much as 15%. We haven't seen the full impact of this price adjustment yet, since the new rules haven't gone into full effect at a state or federal level, but we would expect that the price for the state credits will follow suit if they are made to conform with the new terms of the federal credit. This would make the tax credit far less efficient. It will still require the same level of financial obligation by the state, which is set at 20% of the project costs, but it will just generate less investment capital while increasing complexity for the developer, leading to more uncertainty, sizable financing gaps, and the strong possibility that fewer historic tax credit projects will get off the ground. Given the success that the tax credits have already achieved in Minnesota, we really hope that you will not conform and that we can keep this program as strong as possible. Thank you so much.
Ms. Berg, thank you very much. And so Mr. Eggers up next, and Laura Sales is on deck. So, Mr. Egger, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Paul Egger. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors. We are a trade association with a membership of over 20,000 real estate professionals throughout Minnesota. The Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act made numerous changes to the federal tax code, including provisions affecting current and prospective homeowners. We look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and with the members of the committee to identify opportunities to support home ownership as you develop a conformity bill this session. I also want to highlight an item which Ms. Madden mentioned earlier regarding the property tax refund program, and also thank Representative Loeffler, Representative Davids, and others on this committee last year who worked on this important issue. The Minnesota Department of Revenue's analysis dated December 18, 2018, which I believe you have in your packets, the last item before it reaches the table states, the federal provisions increase the household income amount used to calculate PTR, which would reduce state paid refunds to more than 500,000 homeowners and renters beginning in fiscal year 2021. The property tax refund program is important and provides tax relief directly to homeowners whose property taxes are high relative to their incomes. According to the Minnesota Department of Revenue's 2017 Minnesota Tax Incidence Study, quote, the property tax refunds offset 12.4% of the residential property tax burden, and the refunds offset a much higher portion in the lowest five deciles. We encourage you to prioritize addressing this issue with PTR refunds as part of the federal tax conformity discussion this session. In addition, I just wanted to touch on a couple of items that were in the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018, which was enacted in February of last year. That bill included a couple of homeownership tax extender provisions on mortgage debt cancellation and mortgage insurance premium deductibility. These are more kind of the traditional conformity items that the legislature often has to deal with, and just didn't want to lose those as you move forward in the discussion. And again, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with you and the committee as you consider changes to state tax policy this session in response to the federal TCJA, and we'll try to assist you in identifying opportunities to support homeowners and homeownership in the conformity bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Egger, thank you so much. Laura Sales is up now, and Ann Krisnick is on deck. So, Ms. Sales.
Chair Marquardt, members of the committee, my name is Laura Sales, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We're a labor union of 22,000 bedside nurses who work and live all over Minnesota and parts of Iowa and Wisconsin. We don't testify in the tax committee very often, so I want to take a moment to tell you why we're here today. MNA supports policies that work to raise revenue progressively, and we believe in the development of a fair taxation system. MNA's support for this stems from our intimate understanding that access to the benefits that can come from a fairer tax system can be used to promote better health outcomes for all. I'd like to emphasize a few things from yesterday's presentation on tax conformity. This includes things like when making choices on what to conform to or not, opting for simplicity could come at the cost of creating unacceptable winners or losers in the tax system. Another piece to think carefully about is how you spend one-time money created by your choices. It creates risk to healthcare and other essential public services if permanent expenditures are not matched to permanent revenue sources. So while we don't have any specific policy recommendations for you today, we urge you to keep the following in mind when making decisions about tax conformity. The first would be to not be hasty in your decisions. Because of the breadth of changes in the federal law that was passed, it's my understanding that the 2019 tax filing season was going to be complicated, even if we did enact a tax conformity law in 2018. So rushing to pass a bill quickly to reduce complexity will likely not have any impact on that. Second, using one-time money to reduce a corporate tax rate on an ongoing basis, for example, could create a budget problem for the state. Before looking at reducing corporate tax rates, look at things like strengthening the working family credit, ensuring the state continues to adjust income taxes for family size, or making sure that we don't conform to federal tax changes that would mean smaller state property tax refunds for seniors, people living with disabilities, and family with dependents. So we look forward to working with you this session to help ensure that Minnesota's tax system remains just and fair. Thank you.
Ms. Sales, thank you so much. So Ann Krisnick is up, and Melissa Heising is on deck. So Ms. Krisnick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ann Krisnick. I'm the executive director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is sponsored by the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. We represent people of faith around the state. As you've heard, conforming with the federal tax bill would result for many in increased tax liability, and that's especially true for families with children. The members of our network see in their communities people who are struggling already with working full-time jobs, those who are trying to piece together two or three jobs in order to meet their basic needs. And they hear about struggles when people come to the food shelf or need emergency assistance. According to the Pew Research Center, 17% of evangelical Christian families and 18% of Catholic families have four or more children. This is certainly true of other Minnesota families as well. As you fashion a tax bill, we ask that you continue to make sure that our tax code is responsive to family size and recognizes the needs of struggling families, that you maintain the property tax refund both for homeowners and for renters, and that you expand the working family credit. These tax credits are really a financial lifeline to a lot of these families. They're using them for very basic needs out in their community, buying food and clothing and medicine and diapers, paying rent and mortgages, and addressing long-term repairs that are needed for homes or vehicles. We ask you to address the needs of all of these Minnesotans as you fashion your tax bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Krisnick. Melissa Heising's up now, and Chris Stinson is on deck. So, Ms. Heising.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Taxes Committee. My name is Melissa Heising. I'm the legislative slash research director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We are a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliate unions representing more than 300,000 working people across the state. The 2017 federal tax bill handed large corporations massive permanent tax cuts and temporary individual tax cuts that disproportionately benefit the wealthy few. According to Americans for Tax Fairness, corporations are largely keeping their windfall rather than using it to raise workers' wages. With this in mind, the Minnesota AFL-CIO suggests the following principles for this committee and the legislators to consider when looking at conformity. First, we support using federal adjusted gross income rather than federal taxable income as a starting point so that Minnesota has the opportunity to make better choices about tax policy for working people. Second, Minnesota conformity should not cut corporate taxes any further. Corporations have had more than enough tax breaks. Now is the time for low, moderate, and middle-income individuals and their families to benefit. Third, to echo the testimony of the electrical worker in the Building Trades Council you heard earlier and others, the deduction for unreimbursed employee expenses can amount to thousands of dollars for working people who itemize uniforms, tools, travel, and union dues was eliminated in the 2017 federal tax bill. We would like to see these expenses remain deductible in Minnesota taxes. And finally, to echo many of our union brothers and sisters, tax conformity legislation should have an overall progressive or net positive impact on lower and middle income working Minnesotans. One measure that would help to accomplish this would be the expansion of the working families tax credit. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time today, and we look forward to working with you on these issues.
Thank you very much, Ms. Heising. And our last testifier of the day, Mr. Stinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Stinson. I'm the policy director for SEIU Local 284. We represent more than 9,000 school service employees across the state, and our local is working for a future where students in every Minnesota school have all they need to succeed from pre-K to career. SEIU Local 284 opposes the use of public money, including tax deductions and credits, for private school tuition. Public schools accept all students, including all religions, sexual orientations, gender identities, children of color, children with special needs or learning disabilities, and at a time when we need to address racial and geographic disparities in our schools, vouchers would starve those public schools. Federal tax law allows the use of 529 accounts to pay for private school tuition. That's a provision that we oppose expanding into the state code. And I want to thank Chair Davids for your leadership on this issue. More broadly, we support a tax system that promotes fairness and raises adequate revenue to fund essential services, especially education. Thank you for taking the time.
So, very good. Thank you, Mr. Stinson. We have Ms. Fishman up there. If you can do this in about a minute and a half.
Okay, time me.
So, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I know I'm your last one, and we might go 30 seconds over. I'm the executive director of Prepare and Prosper. We are a nonprofit organization in Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity, as I said, to testify about the importance of a principled fair tax bill that addresses the needs of low and middle income Minnesotans in any state response to the federal tax law. We come to this with our day-to-day experiences as the state's largest provider of free tax assistance. We leverage the expertise of over 550 volunteers to serve around 13,000 people each year, file 25,000 state and federal tax returns, and return about $25 million in tax refunds. We link our customers with savings opportunities at tax time to help them leverage that money moment, and we serve other people with financial coaching and help them meet their financial goals. This week, we are launching the tax season, where we will offer services at 9 locations throughout the Twin Cities. Starting on Saturday, our volunteers who are trained and IRS certified, will be equipped to offer high-quality service to every eligible person who comes through our doors. We are ready for the tax season. As we launch this season, we also know we have a responsibility to weigh in on these legislative deliberations about tax conformity and what form that might take. We're concerned about the new federal tax law's impact on Minnesota's tax system and how it could negatively affect low- and middle-income Minnesotans in the coming year. We recognize that you have to balance a lot of priorities that compete with each other, their opportunity costs, such as ensuring fiscal responsibility, reducing complexity, and we understand that, increasing efficiency, overall fairness, and facilitating economic security for working families. Far too many families are struggling throughout Minnesota, whether it's low income, volatile income, unpredictability in income, and a growing number of people are one emergency away from a financial crisis. So in that spirit, we urge you to support and promote tax conformity in a way that will protect lower and moderate income Minnesotans. This includes, but isn't limited to, expanding the working family credit and protecting the renter's credit. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Ms. Fishman, thank you so much. Appreciate that. We did not get to two testifiers, Mr. Miller and Mr. Iliscus, and we will give you that opportunity first thing tomorrow before Commissioner Bowerly makes her presentation. So I'm sorry we didn't get to you today. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. At the end of all this today, I'd like to sincerely thank the testifiers for their commitment against tax increases on the poor. So we heard a lot of that today. For example, so they're on record not supporting gas tax increases, sick tax increases, business taxes, tobacco taxes, which are all highly and extremely regressive and hurt the poor the most. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, any further comments for the good of the order today? If not, the Tax Committee is adjourned.